This is Aspire, Arch Street Public Radio, broadcasting interviews from our Innovate podcast series. Here's your host, Philip Thomas.
My guest today is Melanie Edwards. Melanie Edwards is the founder and CEO of Mobile Metrics, a market insights and marketing services company serving marginalized communities. Local young adults are employed and trained to collect demographic and consumer data door-to-door in their own neighborhoods using handheld technology. Melanie's experience spans both the private and public sectors. Previous to starting Mobile Metrics, she worked in management for JP Morgan, the International Data Group, and as an executive for key accounts at AT&T. She launched the Global Technology Corps, a digital Peace Corps with the U.S. Department of State, and co-created the United Nations Information Technology Service. Melanie is a returned Peace Corps volunteer from Togo, Africa, a Reuters Digital Vision Fellow at Stanford University, and an Echoing Green Fellow. Melanie's also an adjunct professor of social entrepreneurship at Stanford University and the Columbia Business School. Melanie Edwards, welcome to Innovate Podcast.
Thank you, Philip. It's great to be here.
So, Melanie, tell us, you spent some time in the Peace Corps. How did that influence your career path?
Yeah, Peace Corps was definitely a big seed that was planted that stayed with me to kind of guide what Mobile Metrics is all about today. If I could step back even further than that, another key seed was the community where I grew up. You know, I grew up in a very remote area of the United States on a small family farm. And I'd say that that influenced me in a big way about the power of community and what community can do together and for each other. And of course, I had a mother that was also very others focused, which is also a huge influence. But it was the type of community where, you know, if your cows got out, you know, the neighbors would be putting them back in, right? Or if someone in the town came down with a serious illness and couldn't pay for the healthcare treatment, the whole county would rally to have benefit dinners to help raise money to support that person. So that was very fundamental in retrospect. I didn't realize it at the time. But when I went into Peace Corps, and it was, as you mentioned, in Togo, West Africa, I was also in a remote community, which actually felt like home in many ways, although various differences of no running water and electricity and really being in the bush. But the same spirit of community was very, very, very present where people were taking care of each other. The one difference was I realized being surrounded in these villages, even though they were small geographically, they were very densely populated, that most people were known by any entity to exist, including official identification that they were actually on the planet. And it was just something that was just, I just couldn't get my head around. How could this be in the 20th century at the time that and with the technologies that we had that we would do nothing about these people? And therefore, the outcome of that is if you don't know they exist or what their needs and wants and are, then how can you really serve them? Which ultimately in years, we fast forward to years now with Mobile Metrics, that's really at our core, is how can you serve a population if we don't know who they are and what they need?
So it seems like understanding the community and kind of living among them was core to what you've been doing. But then you also spent time in the private sector, right? Now, what was there something that happened in the private sector that inspired you to become a social entrepreneur? Or was it just a desire right from the beginning and it just so happened you were in the private sector for a while?
Those are great questions, Phil. First of all, you know, back to the Peace Corps experience, yes, being in, quote unquote, the environment, it's a big pet peeve of mine, too. I think, you know, we tend to, in our ivory towers, especially I see it in the university setting, right? We tend to believe that we can come up with solutions. We're not exactly getting into the field. And walking in the moccasins, if you will, of the people is, I believe, the only way to really come up with the best solution and co-engaging with the community members to create that solution. So that's number one. Then jump into the private sector, you know, and I wanted to go in the private sector for many reasons, by the way. I think it's incredible discipline and you know, you can imagine going from Peace Corps to the other extreme of Wall Street as an investment banker in that day was quite the switch. Got my student loans paid off, though. But at the same time, it really gave me appreciation for business and then carrying on and doing the other work that you mentioned with International Data Group, where I was brought into research and then obviously with AT&T into technology. But seeing the power of those three, if you will, sectors blended and the business acumen to apply to social issues really got exciting for me. On the other side, I think, even though, yes, I was going up the ladder, if you will, in the corporate space, there comes a point, at least in my life, and I'm sure the other social entrepreneurs can probably relate to this, where you kind of say, well, you know, what's the there there? You know, why are we here on this planet? And what, you know, what will really fulfill me? And what is my purpose in this finite time that we're walking the earth? And that just kind of propelled me into trying to see how I could blend, and we all have skill sets, right? Everyone listening has a skill set, right? What is it that is your unique calling or skill set that you can apply to something you're passionate about? And so that's what propelled me to move more into the international development space and ultimately mobile metrics.
So let's talk a little bit about that transition. I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Simon Sinek, who starts with the why and the how and the what, and it seems like you answered the why. Now, you wanted to make a social impact. What was the how, and how did you decide on the how, if I may ask that question?
Yeah, I think going back to the days of the Peace Corps and just other voyages around the world, and I kept seeing the same issue, right, over and over and over, as far as low-income communities in particular, just totally being off the grid, so to speak. And I don't mean necessarily electricity-wise or whatever, but just in people not knowing anything. And I saw this when I was at IDG. How could it be that I could tell you what a favorite video game is of a 15-year-old, right? But not how many people lived in a low-income community in Asia or in the favelas of Brazil. And that just, again, I was just mind-boggled. And so we started investigating, right, with the team at Stanford, students started investigating, how is it that people find out how many people live there and what their needs are? And we started really uncovering that a lot of it was just putting fingers in the air and guessing, or using 10-year-old projections, or a lot of countries in which are clients of the World Bank, where they get their data from federal governments, who get it from municipal governments, weren't actually going into the communities to actually do census or even beyond that to get into identifying some of the problems in those areas.
And tell us a little bit more about then mobile metrics. How did mobile metrics come into being? I understand data, I understand technology, but tell our listeners a little more about the story, the genesis of the company.
Having the privilege to be able to go into some of these communities and talk to some of the leaders about the size of the problem and realizing that we're talking basically 4 billion out of the 7 billion on the planet. That's 60% of the population considered low income. And knowing that a lot of the data out there was really built on guesses, and knowing that a lot of this is the real kicker, a lot of the solutions being thrown at the problems were coming from governments, coming from, you know, the equivalents of big foundations, I mean, major foundations, without really knowing or having a baseline of A, what the problem was, and then B, going back and finding out if the impacts, in other words, if their solution they threw at the quote-unquote problem was actually being solved. So, you know, I always believe you got to have a problem to solve. And that seemed like a real glaring, big, hairy, audacious goal. And this was like, oh my gosh, you know, when you saw the ripple effect of this, of these billions of dollars being thrown at it, is it too much, too little, in all the wrong places or the right places? We had no clue. Okay, so what's the solution? Being a big believer in community and these millions of untapped human resources that are really brilliant people. They've just been lacking opportunity. We started thinking, what can we do organically from the ground up to get close to the source and gather the data in a very quick way and reliable way? And so that became the core of, let's mobilize a team of local young adults, which would provide employment, certification as data collectors, and using mobile technology for them to collect it. But it really came out of believing in the people, but also wanting to fulfill an opportunity for them. And then it turned out that that was the most trustworthy as far as accuracy of data. Of course, in market research, the accuracy of the data is a number one. Without that, you're toast. So we just really were laser focused on the selection of the locals and how we do that. And then the training, which we believe are our two greatest means of assuring and ensuring quality control.
Now, you developed the model and then you went and decided to do this in Brazil. Tell us about why Brazil and what were some of the challenges that you faced taking this model into Brazil and building the company from there?
Oh boy, that's a whole other conversation, but I'll try to abbreviate. Yeah, I had to pick a country, and obviously I knew it was going to take a while to get any company up anywhere. Chose Brazil, both professionally and personally. Professionally, I had a lot of contacts who had contacts in the communities, in the low-income communities, or what they call the favelas. And that's obviously fundamental, is having another known entity that you can go in with until you yourself are really, and your entity is well-known. Also, Brazil was, especially at the time, it's changed obviously today quite a bit, but very much let's try it kind of attitude. You know, people were really eager on the community front. We found out later, not so much on the government front, but on the community front to really raise visibility about their realities. So that was a key driver too. And just the entrepreneurial spirit of the Brazilians. Then from a launching from a company perspective, oh, this is a whole book. I was very naive, I'll be really honest, of how difficult it was to launch a business in Brazil. For example, it took us 3.5 months to get a bank account. It took me about 3 years to get residency, to be able to have a work visa. And this is just typical bureaucracy. I mean, the amount of taxes, whether you're a nonprofit or for-profit, you're paying taxes. So there are financial hits that were harsh and hard. The work actually in the favelas was a piece of cake compared to building a business, the legalities and the accounting that go with that in Brazil. Then again, I figured if we could do it there in Brazil, I guess, in hindsight, and if we can do this kind of work in the, you know, drug riveted and gang riveted favelas with the tensions with the police that are in them, then perhaps we could do this anywhere.
Now, you briefly talked about some of the bureaucracy that goes in, but in any situation where you're collecting primary research from the ground up, there is always that possibility that some of that research might contradict the perception that a government may want to kind of show people outside. Was that a struggle for you? And if so, how did you go about overcoming that struggle of kind of speaking the truth in a sense? And power, not necessarily liking the truth that was being said.
Yeah, this is huge, Philip. Well, it goes back to my naivete. 75 to 85% of the population of Brazil are considered low income. So I figured if we could crack the nut on how to really identify some of the major wants, needs, habits, behaviors of the Brazilian at the base of the pyramid, that the government would love us and embrace us. We had a staggering start with the government, and I ended up finding, well, how else can we, you know, back to what you're saying, how else can we get the truth or this reality out? We realized, well, let's go the route of contracting with corporates, contracting with other nonprofits, with universities. So that's the angle we ended up going as far as getting clients, because the business model is such that they contract Mobile Metrics. Mobile Metrics turns around and does the hiring, training, and basically management of data collection. But there came a point where it became pretty obvious that they, even though they would, we'd get a nod from the government, they certainly didn't embrace it. But our model is such that we collect the data now, and a large portion of that data goes public immediately, such as the demographics. Such as, for example, when we did a project with dengue fever, the government had predicted a 4% infection rate in the favelas, and we discovered 22% infection rate. And that particular project was with Johnson & Johnson, and J&J, as well as us, immediately were like, yes, that has to go public immediately. So that's just how we came up with other ways to get at the truth, the data, and to make it known.
This episode of Innovate is brought to you by 19th Street Press and Queen of Angels, the debut novel from David Castro. Queen of Angels contrasts Shakespeare with gritty, profane 70s New York. Not only is the novel a compelling exploration of young love, it's a gripping piece of storytelling, says Publishers Weekly. Queen of Angels by David Castro from 19th Street Press.
You briefly referenced the concept of the bottom of the pyramid. And for our listeners, tell us a bit about the bottom of the pyramid, but also how, while in the world of social entrepreneurship, people do refer to the bottom of the pyramid, for a lot of governments that have large populations in that sector is almost like that family relative they'd like to kind of forget, because it's not sexy, you know, to kind of have them there. How do you transform the thinking of people who have not seen themselves as an asset to seeing themselves as assets and very lively and viable market opportunities for corporations?
To me, the base of the pyramid is really exciting, and not just for sheer volume. Again, the 4 billion out of 7 billion in the world. Yeah. But I really, really do believe in these incredible untapped human resources. I've seen them. And it's just almost for want of an opportunity, and they're soaring. And by the way, I also believe in the power of government in the sense of, yes, they have a huge role here. And if anyone to kind of convince that we're on their side, you know, that's what I love to do. I think, you know, sometimes we could be seen as spotlighting issues and shining a light on, for example, that there are so many open sewers in a community, and therefore if they know how many, then they have to put in the money to correct those sewers or get more clinics or more schools, that type of thing. So that's kind of the, you know, downside to knowing the truth in some ways, right? But the upside is, again, shining light on all the opportunity of the people themselves, and really empowering the people to come about and design their own solutions. A lot of the work with the corporates has been amazing. And this was kind of my aha as we went along, and even had to readjust, right, from focusing on governments to focusing on corporates. At the end of the day, I woke up and you know, you guys could do this right now. Look around where you're sitting, the listeners as well as you. All of us are surrounded by things that were made by the private sector. If government made antibacterial soap, we'd be working with the government. And then the aha was, why don't we just go direct to whoever has the greatest, most powerful, life-improving products and services? That's what we need, and that's what they need. And not only that, but when the relationships are built between the people in these communities and those corporates that have those life-improving products and services, can you imagine what happens then? Hmm. And it's so amazing. And that was something I didn't see at the beginning of creating Mobile Metrics, but I'm such a believer in now. And it's starting to turn some of these corporates into more social businesses. Because, by the way, part of the model with Mobile Metrics is we don't go in and strip mine for data and leave. Just be real clear about that. We're going in, and the differentiators are, one, you know, hiring the local young adults, hiring and training them and using mobile devices to collect the data. But there's always a social return, or we won't work with the company. And those social returns also makes business sense. Because in doing this, it's paving the way for the corporates to go in to these communities and build relationships and having trust that, again, totally changes the dynamic when it comes down to marketing your products, building your products, you know, product development, whether it be, you know, product design and immersions, so that the executives of these corporations go in and get that visceral experience with the locals and start talking directly to the mobile agents on the front lines or the community leadership and co-creating this together. That's where the power is. So it's not necessarily the data, but the after ripple effect.
Sure. I'd like you to tell our listeners the types of services that you provide.
Sure. Market research services. And like I mentioned, you know, that can be, the core has been primary research, where the model that I described, where there's been a lot of a door-to-door, where you get really deep and valuable data. Particularly, it's important in low-income communities because we're finding over and over there's an inherent suspicion and distrust. So that's why it's so key to have the locals really engaged and pressing the flesh on many occasions. The other things that we've been engaged in would be focus groups. We've done a lot of pre- and post-testing of products. Co-creation, I mentioned workshops on product development, immersions with executives who are wanting to come and get more familiar with the reality so that they can go back to the drawing board and be more informed.
And you obviously train your local agents on data collection. Tell us a little bit about the training process of the training program that you use for local agents, including the process through which you select the local agents.
It's key at every step of the way that we're engaged with the community and community leadership. So they help us in shortlisting the potential young adults. And by the way, I gotta have to say, it's pretty obvious I'm a foreigner to a lot of these environments, including here in the United States, in East Harlem. So even more so that is good. And our team, right now, our Brazilian team, apart from me, is 100% Brazilian. But even there, to look deeper, we have Brazilians who are from the upper class in Brazil, but probably 50% of our team, our core team, is from the communities themselves. So that's really key because that helps liaise very easily with the community leadership and get to that shortlist, then go in and we finalize the selection and begin the training. By the way, I should say that to date, we have over 150 mobile agents trained in both Brazil and the United States to collect data and have reached probably 50,000 people in our research and done over 12,000 surveys. And as far as the product and service delivery, that's well over 200,000 products and or services delivered back. So a small group can do a lot, particularly in this urban favela or low-income areas, which are very densely populated.
Now, within the work that you do, technology is something that you're very dependent on. What kind of technologies do you use and how do you get the technologies? Is it easily available in the communities that you work in, or do you have to bring it in from outside and train your local agents on the use of the technology?
It depends on the country and the tariffs, the way we go. We're very technology agnostic, and that goes also for the software, although we found a really great software company that we love working with. But there's a lot of other survey software out there. But just be really clear, we're technology agnostic. And certain devices are more durable than others. As you can imagine, these are kind of rough environments. Not that the mobile agents are rough on them. As a matter of fact, we've had mobile agents who, between interviews, bring a towel with them and clean the screen. Because this is like your laptop, right? You know, it's like this is your work tool, and they so much care for the device. It's more that there's a lot of dust and dirt in the communities. If it rains and you're kind of trying to do, you know, surveys outside, you know, things. So we're really looking at durability of the device. But we bring the devices to the table. They're trained on the devices. The data is encrypted at the moment that you close the survey out. So if something were to get lost, and I need to say, because I get this a lot, people always ask me, what about getting stolen and whatnot? And to date, knock on wood, we have not had any device ever stolen. And I attribute that to, again, the communities themselves. They know that we're there to do something for the community. And they are at nothing but supportive. And this includes the gangs, which, you know, everyone thinks, oh my gosh, the gangs are the bad guys. Not necessarily, you know, and other realities, as we learn, a lot of people sometimes obviously have relatives that we're hiring and training that have affiliations, because it's, again, it's a very tightly knit community.
Tell us a little bit about the partnerships that you have to develop. Any organization like yours needs good partners. How do you go about cultivating partners, and who are some of the partners that have been key to contributing to where you are right now?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. Oh, my gosh. I would say, you know, starting with our origins at Stanford, providing a space, and the energetic students that came from all over, all walks of life, all around the world. I'd say, you know, we just had, and you can see from our website, we've had partners who joined us, whether they be financially or whether they be through advice, such as Avena, Holler and Philanthropies. We've had Equine Green, who have believed early on in us. And, you know, this seems to be a thread, and I'm sure most of the people you probably interviewed, and well, everybody in the world, we've had someone who rolled the dice on us. And we're, you know, took a chance, and we are forever endeared to them. And people like the late Pamela Hardigan, who believed in me, believed in the model of mobile metrics early on, and she believed in so many others. And having someone like that in your corner just really has lifted me and the organization. Those are key. You know, I have to give a shout out to the heroes in all of this. They're the community leaders. And we always ask the community leader if, and by the way, for those listening who might not know, a leader could be someone who decided they wanted to start a nonprofit in their community, or they could be the head of the church, or they could be someone who was elected as the head of the homeowners association for the community. They could take many forms, but there's someone who's really been respected over the years in their community because they've been giving back. And when you have that type of person say yes, because really this is their project, not our project, and they're going to champion it, then, you know, they become the most important partner of all, because really, like I said, they're our primary client, the community and the community leadership. And they have been the heroes and heroines that I've ever seen, you know, and what they've had to overcome to do what they do. And knock on wood, to date, we've had none who've said no to being a champion. But it really is, everyone has skin in the game. And these people who have to, well, take someone who like runs the tenants association at a public housing complex in Wagner, or excuse me, the East Harlem, who's having to walk between the landlord of the New York Housing Authority of the government and, you know, the gangs that exist there. And by the way, there are two factions in one complex, and, you know, her own residents and her own board. I mean, if that's not diplomacy,
right?
You know,
along with your role as a CEO of the company, you're also teaching at several universities and colleges. As an educator, what do you tell tomorrow's social entrepreneur, and what do you see in the horizon about the future of social entrepreneurship, considering the students that you're interacting with?
It's another highlight of what I do, and I'm such a privilege to be in those institutions and see kind of the next budding generation, if you will, of social entrepreneurs. But what I see happening, and it's funny, even though we put a lot of focus on social entrepreneurs, which I don't like, by the way, and nothing to all of the organizations, they're great, but it's not really about the individuals so much as the team that
right.
implements.
Sure.
Because without the team, you know, obviously we can't do what we do because the problems we're trying to take on are too big. But what I'm seeing now is it's even lifting out social entrepreneurship. And, you know, again, the trend is that for every business to survive, it will have to have a social and or environmental bottom line. So every business will have to be a social business.
Right.
And that's kind of the message that, again, back to Pamela Hardigan, who started, you know, parlaying this to the students and, you know, carrying that message forth. It's so, so true. You look around you, you've got now not just the younger companies that are startups doing the social return on investment and social environmental blend, but you've got the big, big corporations like a Unilever trying to turn its ship to be more social and environmental in its products, right? And whatever goes into the making of its detergents and soaps. You've got a lot of bigger companies trying to move to be more quote unquote sustainable. And not just the whitewashing, greenwashing that's happening, which is true, but I think there's some at their core who get it, that they're people they're trying to attract, their consumers are voting now with not only their dollars, but they're now voting with their careers.
Wow. Tell us a little bit more about the plans for expansion for Mobile Metrics. What's next for the organization?
Well, next is we see huge opportunities here in the United States that have gone neglected. I think that has become pretty obvious. I mentioned working, we just expanded in the U.S. last year into Harlem. We are looking now to expand more into the Midwest, Rust Belt, and Appalachia. There's some ideas bantering around on where can we do the greatest impact in what would be the partners to make the greatest win-win on that. So that's where our energies are currently focused. Obviously, we're also being quartered to expand more into Latin America, which most likely be our next natural place of going. We've had shout outs from countries in India, Kenya, South Africa that are kind of more on the back burner, but we were just trying to be very strategic on where we go next and why and with whom. And obviously, if there's impact enough, we'll consider other things. But it's not easy to go wide and deep at the same time. And as you can imagine, like I said, there are things very complex depending on the markets, which I've learned my lesson about investigating much more deeply. Of course, being a foreigner starting out in these countries isn't easy, but now we've got more people from other places that could obviously do the job much better than I, but for expansion purposes. But anyway, that's the big next step is looking at how we can go deeper here in our own backyard, which, Philip, as you know, it's being spotlighted. Yeah. That it's, you know, more and more an emerging market than we ever could have imagined.
Sure. One last question. For people who listen to this podcast, they may be asking themselves how they could find out more, how they could get involved. What kind of folks are you looking for that might be pulled from our group of listeners, and how can they get involved with you?
Thanks for asking. Certainly. We're always looking for people who are passionate about providing opportunity for low-income communities. We're always looking for people who are passionate about helping to change the system of market research from just data mining to making sure there's a social return. And so that becomes the adopted model for everyone that is doing research, that there is there's a win-win. And it's really not for everybody, right? The environments we work in aren't easy. So kind of give thought to that too. Having said that, I can guarantee it's the most rewarding thing, certainly the most rewarding work that I've ever done. They used to say Peace Corps was the job that the hardest job you'll ever love. Yes, but this is by far the one that I'm most passionate about, because there's nothing more like seeing someone transform, these mobile agents literally transform before your eyes, and the communities transform before your eyes.
Melanie Edwards, thank you so much for talking to us at Innovate Podcast.
Philip, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for joining us today. Our library of interviews and a range of further resources are available at our website, innovatepodcast.org. Aspire and Innovate are produced in partnership with Ashoka, Innovators for the Public, the Kellogg Fellows Leadership Alliance, the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal, and by Arch Street Press. For PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.